We are in Ruth, and we finished the first two chapters last week. The first two chapters establish the lineage of the characters, what families they're from. It establishes the timeline. It's pegged to the harvests. And it also establishes Ruth's character. Now we're going to get into a whole bunch of other stuff. And I will say this several times to make sure that it gets on the recording. The stuff I'm going to show you today, I got from Rabbi Foreman at alephbeta.org. It is his insight. I didn't have that insight by myself. The other thing is I'm going to show you slides. And I was taught as a rather young presenter, don't read the slides to the audience. They can read. I am going to break that rule because the only thing that is going to be recorded is the audio. So I'm not trying to insult you and imply that you can't read. I just want to make sure that the slides get on the recording. So Ruth has been gleaning in Boaz's field. Boaz has instructed his people to let her do that. And furthermore, to make sure that she has a good day gleaning. So he says to them, it's okay if she gleans among the sheaves. It's okay if you leave a little extra for her, pull some out, make sure she has a good day. The reason that instruction is kind of important is because the Torah says you don't harvest your field to the corners and you don't go back and pick up anything you've forgotten. You leave that for the stranger, the orphan, and the widow. And that's what Torah says, and certainly that's what's required. However, having said that, there isn't anything in that instruction that tells you anything about the character of the sojourner, the orphan, or the widow. So if you get a sojourner, orphan, or a widow whose character is not quite sterling and who gets a bit aggressive, you may find that you lose more of your harvest than just the gleanings. So when Boaz tells his harvesters, don't mess with her. Even if she gets up among the sheaves, don't worry about it. That's the reason for that instruction. By the way, I've got a bunch of slides and a whole bunch of explanation to do, and I will do that after we're done reading the text. We'll read the text and make comments as we normally do, and then we'll start doing the slides. So, chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight in the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say, I will do. Now, obviously, the modern American mind goes to, she's going to be a harvest follower, and there's going to be some hanky-panky going on. That is not the case, obviously. You've all read the book. What she's going to do is, by uncovering his feet and laying at his feet and covering herself with his garment, she is saying, take me under your protection. So it's a proposal on her part. She wants him to play the part of a redeemer, and as part of that, she wants him to marry her. So it's a proposal, if you will, not a proposition. Verse 6. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. This is the barley harvest, by the way. This is Passover time. They have finished threshing the grain and they're going to camp out by the grain that they have just threshed in order to make sure that the pile doesn't get diminished overnight. They have been working hard all day, threshing the grain. This is the payday for their work. And so they'll guard it until they can get it stored somewhere safe. And oh, by the way, it's a happy occasion. So when they are done working and have got the grain threshed and everything, the wine comes out and we have a small feast and so forth. And by the way, you see the same thing happening in Samuel, where David is running a protection racket in the Shephelah, and when Nabal is getting ready to shear his sheep, he has set up a big party. Sheep shearing for a shepherd is a payday. So we're going to shear all the sheep, and oh, by the way, we're going to have a feast, and we're going to eat, and we're going to drink, because this is the end of the season. And of course, David sends some of his men up there and says, hey, during all this time this year, you haven't lost any sheep. Nobody's bothered you. And by the way, that's because I was watching. So how about if you give me and my men some of this party that you're having? And Nabal says, who's David? I don't know him. I don't know him anything. When David gets that word, he says, I will go teach him a lesson. And of course, Abigail, Nabal's wife, short-circuits that by meeting David on his way up and giving him part of the feast, and Nabal, when he finds out, dies, and David winds up marrying Abigail. But the point is, a harvest or a sheep shearing or any of those kinds of things are celebrations at the end of the day's hard work. And so that's what's going on here at the barley harvest. So verse 8, at midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. What she's done is she is formally claiming the fact that he is her redeemer and asking him to act on that. And he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, neither whether poor nor rich. Okay, this theme of kindness is going to be all through what I'm going to go through at the end. And the whole point of redemption in this case is to prevent the loss of the line of somebody who dies without issue. To do that requires somebody to be kind. It's going to be an imposition to do the stuff that's necessary to carry this guy's line on. And furthermore, the firstborn child of that union inherits what the dead man would have inherited, and you don't. And of course, we see that in the story of Judah, where he's got three sons. The first one marries Tamar and dies for some reason, but God took him out. Scripture said he was wicked, don't know what the problem was. So his brother, Onan, marries the widow. Well, Onan doesn't want to divide his inheritance. He wants everything that would have come to his brother. So when he cohabits with his brother's widow, he makes sure that he does not impregnate her. That way, a child born of that union wouldn't get the firstborn's inheritance. Onan will get the firstborn's inheritance, which is what he wants. So what is going on here, as I say, is Ruth is claiming her right of redemption, and the question becomes, are you going to do it, Boaz? Now, Boaz, based on what he just said, is apparently an older man. Ruth is a hot young chick, and there are lots of young men around, and it was Boaz's assumption that she was going to marry some younger guy. And when she doesn't and comes to him, he is flattered. Verse 11, now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. Now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So, if you go back to Leviticus, which is where this idea of redemption is first mentioned, what it is, if someone sells himself, for example, as a slave because he can't afford to take care of himself, his nearest kinsman is the first redeemer. Should his nearest kinsman not be able to do it, then some other kinsman can redeem him, but the hierarchy, if you will, is closeness in birth. So your first redeemer would be your brother. Well, if you don't have a brother, then your uncle. Well, if you don't have an uncle, then there's a hierarchy to all this. And by the way, Boaz can't just say, well, let's just get married, because there is a field involved. So he could just flat out marry Ruth and be done with it, but then he wouldn't be in a position to also buy the field. Verse 14, so she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. In other words, you can tell shapes, but you can't tell much else. So she laid his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. In other words, I do not want your reputation damaged. And he said to her, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she holds your skirt out, basically. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. What's happening here, Ruth doesn't have any idea. She just thinks that she's gotten a gift of a bunch of grain. The fact that it's 6 measures means a great deal to Naomi, because Naomi, knowing her scriptures or whatever they had those days, 6 is 1 less than 7. 7 is complete, therefore 6 is incomplete. In other words, this matter is not complete, and I am going to make sure that it gets complete, is what that is saying. Naomi gets it, Ruth's got no idea. I mean, Naomi may have told her, but the beginning, she has no idea what's going on. Chapter 4. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz says, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So what he's doing is he's establishing witnesses in the gate. The gate is like the county courthouse, or the town square, if you will, and he's got 10 proper witnesses and the guy he's going to transact business with. And the other redeemer, not being any fool, recognizes, okay, something official is going on here. This is not just, hey, how about a cup of coffee? We're transacting business. So verse 2 again. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit here. So they sat down. Then he said to the redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belongs to our relative, Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it this day. Buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. If you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. So he said, here's what we're talking about, parcel of land. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, not so fast there. So then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. So the reason she is selling is so that she can get an heir for her dead husband and her dead sons. Verse 6, and the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I empire my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. There we have some variation on the situation that I talked about with Onan. There's something going on that if he marries Ruth and gets children on her, it's going to mess up other arrangements he has going on. So he said, nope, sorry, can't do that. Verse 7. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahalon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahalon, I have bought to be my wife, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. So this is a formal statement, obviously, of what's going on. By the way, the business of taking off your sandal, that isn't entirely the ceremony as it is described in the Torah. In the Torah, the ceremony is the woman who will not be redeemed. In this case, it would be Ruth. If the near kinsman refuses to redeem her, she takes off his sandal and spits in his face. And thus shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. There isn't any spitting going on here. So apparently that's sort of become just symbolically take the sandal off and that's good enough. So we have this formal thing that's set up now. So verse 11, that all the people who were at the gate of the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman. So I'm going to stop here, and I'm going to now switch to the slides that I have. And as I have said at the beginning of this, and I will now say again, none of this information is original with me. I got it all from Rabbi Foreman. I'm not going to do it the way he did it, but the ideas and everything are his. Rabbi Foreman has got an excellent series, like 6 or 8 videos on all of this. And so this is distilled from those. So Levirate marriage, the word in Hebrew is ibum. And the first case that we have is Lot in Sodom. The deal there is Lot is in Sodom. He went to Sodom knowing that the place was wicked. When Lot and Abraham separated, they came out of Egypt and they had great wealth and they were both up on the central highlands. And the area they were in was simply not big enough to provide grazing for all their flocks and herds. So Abraham says, all right, choose. You go one way, I'll go the other. And Lot looked down and he saw the valley of the Dead Sea. And he saw that it was beautiful and well-watered. So he took that and he went and lived in Sodom. And the thing about Sodom is that it was known to be wicked when he went. It was not the case that he went to Sodom and then figured it out. At the point where he makes his decision, it specifically says in Torah, and the men of Sodom were wicked. So he's chosen to go down there and live. Of course, when God finally has enough with Sodom, first he does lunch with Abraham, and this is where Rabbi Foreman goes on a riff about kindness, because Abraham, although he is still a bit out of commission from just having been circumcised, goes out and offers his guests a meal and so forth and treats them well and treats them kindly. This is in contrast to the way that they are treated when they get to Sodom, where they are not treated kindly at all. It is apparently the policy of Sodom to sodomize travelers and let that word get out so that nobody comes around. So you have the contrast, if you will, of Abraham being kind and hospitable and Sodom being evil and inhospitable. Rabbi Foreman makes a big deal of that because, as I said at the beginning, the whole concept of Levirate marriage is somebody is doing a kindness to someone who is dead by perpetuating his name. And also, Judah's son, Onan, was not willing to do that kindness. And that made God seriously grumpy, and Onan died. So, after the destruction of Sodom, where we are is everything that Lot has been destroyed. He has no heir. And Lot's daughters had absolutely no prospects. So the daughters decide to carry on the family line. They're in a cave and they cohabit with him. And we have two sons born, Moab and Ben-Ami. And of course, Moab is an ancestor of Ruth. So reason for this is A, it is a case of perverse Levirate marriage. The girls are trying to do the right thing, which is provide their father with an heir. It isn't clear that the father's motives are so pure, although he is drunk at the time, so it's hard to tell. But the idea here is a boom, but not carried out as it should be. And the daughters get themselves pregnant by deception. By the way, that is in Genesis 19, starting in verse 30. So the next one we have is Judah and Tamar. And I've already sort of led into that because Judah has three sons, Er, Onan, and Shelah. Onan did something that God was displeased with. We're never told what. And he dies. So Tamar is owed a child to be the heir of Er. So Judah gives her Onan, and Onan, of course, doesn't want to cooperate. Happy to have her in his bed, but doesn't want any children by her. So God takes him out. Well, that leaves Shelah. And at this point, Judah is thinking this gal is bad news. And so when Shelah becomes of age, he doesn't do anything. So Tamar takes matters into her own hand and tricks Judah into cohabiting with her. And Judah, when he discovers that his daughter-in-law is pregnant, gets all irate and indignant. And by the way, when Judah cohabits with Tamar, he is a widower. He is not married. So it's not like he's committing adultery. I mean, you can say what you want about him messing around with what he thinks is a temple prostitute, but it is not adultery. He does not have a wife at that point. So she gets pregnant, as she intended, and Judah gets all indignant at the fact that she has gone out and gotten herself pregnant because he thinks she's been fooling around with who knows whom, and so he orders her to be executed. Tamar, then, when she cohabited with Judah, basically took the keys to the Lexus and his credit card as security. And so she then sends back his cord and his signet, says, the guy who owns these is the father of this child. And he acknowledges that he is the father. In this, he behaves kindly, which is to say, he could have said, boy, are you in trouble, babe, because she never names him. She simply sends his credentials back to him and says, the guy that owns these is the father. And furthermore, out of that, he also gets two sons. In the case of Lot, one son from each of two women. Here, twins from Tamar. And when Judah accepts responsibility, he regains these two sons that would have been lost to him. And it turns out that Perez is going to be the one we're interested in. So this is, again, a slide that I got from Rabbi Foreman. And what you have is where Lot and Sodom and Judah and Tamar appear in the text. Lot and Sodom, you have the story of Abraham. Starts in Genesis 12 and goes to Genesis 24. All about Abraham. Except Genesis 19 is plunked right there in the middle, and it's a story of Lot and Sodom. Same thing happens with Joseph. So Genesis 37 through Genesis 50 is the story of Joseph. Except you have Judah and Tamar plunked in the middle in Genesis 38. This is now genealogy, this is not formanology. What's going on here is you have in these two storylines two men, Abraham and Lot, Joseph and Judah. And those two men are placed in similar circumstances. In the case of Abraham and Lot, they are placed in a position where they can exercise hospitality and kindness. Abraham succeeds, Lot tries, but doesn't succeed. In the case of Joseph, what you have is Joseph is tempted by Potiphar's wife. And then the next incident is Judah and Tamar. So you have two men tempted by sexual sin, if you will, side by side, so you can compare their reactions. Now, the thing about Judah and Joseph, at the death of Jacob, Jacob blesses his sons. And he blesses both Joseph and Judah differently. Joseph gets the blessing of Abraham. Judah gets the blessing of leadership. And the thing that allows Judah to be a suitable leader is when Benjamin is kidnapped, if you will, by Joseph. Nobody knows who Joseph is. They just think he's a high Egyptian official. And Joseph frames his brother Benjamin, says, I'm going to take this guy for a slave. And Judah steps up and said, no, take me. And in that, he has demonstrated the character of taking responsibility and being a leader. And that character turn is shown up here in Genesis 38 when he takes responsibility for what has happened to Tamar. So he could get away with saying, boy, are you in trouble, babe? Go ahead and burn her. He could get away with that. And furthermore, the story of Judah and Tamar, it becomes obvious that Judah cares what people think of him. So when he tries to redeem his credentials from her and the guy he sends can't find her, he specifically says, all right, forget it, lest people start to laugh at us. So he really cares what people think about him. So for him to transcend that and stand up in front of everybody and say, I'm responsible here, she's more righteous than I am, that is a character shift. And the combination of that character shift and then his subsequent being able to stand up and say, no, don't take Benjamin. My father couldn't stand it. I will substitute for him. Those are both character traits of someone who is qualified for leadership. If Judah doesn't do that, then he isn't qualified for leadership. Furthermore, if he has Tamar burned, then the two children that she is carrying also die. And Perez is going to turn out to be the one who carries the line forward to David and the Messiah. The question is, why would Shelah not be in the line of the Messiah instead of Perez? Several reasons. Reason number one is we don't have any idea who Judah's first wife was. She was not a Hebrew. We also don't know about Tamar. But Tamar certainly understands the laws of levirate marriage. And since the penalty that he prescribes for her is that she be burned as opposed to stoned, elsewhere in Torah, it says specifically that the daughter of a priest, if she commits adultery, will be burned as opposed to stoned. None of that's definitive. We really don't know what Tamar comes from, but Shelah basically disappears into the masses, never hear from him again. And things go forward with Perez. And that's the whole point of this. So I just explained the similarities between the story of Lot and the story of Judah and Tamar are the way they're placed in the text. So the Abraham story, and all of a sudden, plunk, in the middle of it, we have this vignette about Lot and Sodom. Same thing. We have a large chunk of text about Joseph, and then plunk, in the middle of it, you've got Judah and Tamar. So the two things are connected because they're similar. So this is his list of similarities. First off, position in the text. That's what I just described. The series focuses on a relative of the main character. So the series really focuses on Abraham and Joseph, but the main character becomes Lot and Judah. They're both seduction stories. Both Tamar and Lot's daughters trick the father of their child. Tamar never comes up and says straight up, "Hey, somebody needs to get me pregnant here." She tricks him and seduces him. Same thing with Lot's daughters. In both cases, the women initiate. The guys aren't looking to have any kids at this point, and it's the women who initiate things. Women employ deception, and the women's motive is ensuring that the family line is not lost. The men's motives are less pure. And then in both cases, we have two sons who are born. So those two stories, if you will, are in a whole bunch of ways parallel. And it's Rabbi Thurman's observation that when the Torah does something like that, the Torah is drawing your attention to it. As I said before, the Torah is rather terse, and so it gives you more information by organization, even though things are not stated explicitly. So here we have the genealogies from Lot and Sodom. One of the results is Moab. Ruth is a Moabite. And similarly, from Judah and Tamar, Perez is one of the results, and Boaz is a descendant of Perez. This is the genealogy from Terah. He has three sons, Abram or Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Haran dies young. And Haran has a son, Lot, and a daughter, Iscah. Iscah may be Sarah. Now, why do I say that? Well, you remember when Abraham goes down to Egypt and goes to Gerar, he has Sarah tell people, "She's my sister." And everybody says, "Wow, that's really stinky." Where I want to be is in Genesis 20. Abraham has told Abimelech, "She's my sister." And somebody sees them showing affection to one another, which is Bible speak for something. And Abimelech says, "Wait a minute, that's not his sister." And he gets highly indignant and has a dream. And in the dream, God tells him, "Do not touch that woman or you're going to die." And Abimelech says, "I've been completely innocent here." And God says, "I know, make sure you stay that way." And then Abimelech goes to Abram and says, "What have you done to us? Somebody might have taken your wife and then it would have been just terrible." So in verse 8, Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told them all these things, and the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said to Abram, "What did you see that you did this thing?" Abram said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife." Verse 12, "Besides, she is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife." Now, if we look at the family tree we have here, Iscah is the daughter of Haran. And in Bible speak, that means that Terah could be called Iscah's father. In other words, father, grandfather, etc. So the idea that Iscah could be the daughter of Haran, who could be Sarah, comes from that. So what has happened here is Nahor takes Milcah, who is a daughter of Haran. So Nahor takes Milcah, and he begets Bethuel, Rebekah, Leah, and Rachel. So Nahor is showing kindness to his dead brother by taking his daughter as wife, with the idea that children born to her, the firstborn, will be the heir of Haran. Similarly, if this chart is correct, Abram does the same thing with Haran's other daughter. So you have, if you will, two Levirate marriages of the two daughters of Haran to the two surviving brothers. Abram gets Sarah, or Ishka, and Nahor gets Milcah. They are both perpetuating the line of their dead brother. And then, if you look over here at the bottom left-hand corner, Abraham is the father of the patriarchs. So Abraham fathers Isaac, who fathers Jacob. Nahor is the father of the matriarchs. So he fathers Rebekah, Rachel, and Leah. So the two brothers, if you will, father all of the line of Israel. All of Israel basically is a descendant of Terah. Now, the other thing that is going on here, which is equally important, is whereas Lot's daughters and Tamar use deception to get pregnant, Ruth does not. First place, remember, the story emphasizes her kindness. So she had a chance to leave her mother-in-law when all the men died. She chose instead to stay with her mother-in-law. And one of the big deals is Naomi's an old woman. Ruth is a healthy young woman who was able to work. And so she then stays with her mother-in-law to care for her. And she does that by gleaning and all that kind of thing. So she is showing kindness to her mother-in-law, which is what Boaz says, by the way. Boaz says, everybody knows how kind you have been to your mother-in-law. And the fact that you have asked me to be your redeemer is a further kindness, because I'm no spring chick. And you could have gotten yourself a younger, stronger buck than what you did. So Ruth, if you will, brings everything together, and she does it through kindness, and she does it through honorable dealing, as opposed to the other two who do it sneakily. So let's go ahead and finish up the book, and we'll call it quits. So we are all the way down to chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Notice there's only one son involved here, as opposed to two sons in each of the previous cases. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." What has happened here is Naomi has also obtained some security for her old age, because Ruth's son would be obligated to take care of his grandmother, which is perfectly fine. Verse 16, "Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi.' They named him Obed, and he is the father of Jesse, the father of David." Now these are the generations of Perez. Remember, now we're going back to Perez, who is Judah's son by Tamar. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Solomon. Solomon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. So you have then from Perez 10 generations to David. David is the 10th generation from Perez. So whole bunch of stuff going on in this little four-chapter book. And I am very indebted to Rabbi Foreman for doing all the work to unpack all that, because you sort of knew it, but having it all put together like that was a real blessing. And I recommend that if you are interested, you go to alephbeta.org and watch his series on it, because he does a whole lot more than what I just did. There's a lot more there. So what's happened here is all of the scattered lines that came out of Terah have now come back together. One of the things I mentioned last time, and I will mention now again in closing, is the idea of a near kinsman being a redeemer, all throughout the Torah, and of course, central to the book of Ruth. And therein lies our claim to salvation by Yeshua. Therein is the reason that Yeshua came as a man, because as a man, he is a descendant of Adam, who messed things up, and so he is a near kinsman in that sense to all of us, and he is therefore qualified to be our Redeemer. And so, if you will, the claims of Christ to be a Redeemer to humanity are also central to this book. Shama.